All right, today we are going to wrap up our Advent series, which we're calling This Changes Everything. And what we've been talking about is how the coming of Jesus into the world changes everything. And we've shown how, in a historical sense, it changes the way we view the church as family. We're brothers and sisters. Changes our view of hope. And we've shown how, historically, it changes even our understanding of truth. And today I want to wrap it up by showing how the coming of Christ changes and has changed historically our understanding of humility. There was a famous public speaker in the ancient world, and a bunch of people wanted to learn from him and learn, how is it that you're so good at public speaking? And so they asked him, what's the first rule for being eloquent in public speaking? And he answered, delivery. It's how you deliver a speech that matters the most. And so they asked him, okay, well then what's the second most important thing in giving a public speech? And he answered, delivery. They asked him a third time, well, what's the third one, anticipating where he was going? And again, he said, delivery. One of the most famous Christians in Christian history is a man named Augustine. Augustine was reflecting on this quote and this story, and he said, in the same way, if you ask me, what are the greatest principles, the greatest precepts of Christianity, I will answer in the first, the second, and the third place, humility. In fact, Augustine went on to say, humility is the foundational virtue of all virtues. It's the root under all good things, like patience, like love for one another. Humility is the foundation of all other virtues. And of course, we also know that the flip side of this is pride. Pride is the root of all of our problems. It's pride that is at the root of your anger. It's pride that is at the root of your self-centeredness. It's pride that causes you to knock heads with other people. It's either their pride or it's your pride, or if we're being really honest, it's probably both. C.S. Lewis captures, I think, this so well, this effect of pride in bringing destruction to our relationships. He wrote a famous little book called The Great Divorce. And in this book, he imagined a kind of a fictional hell. And so this man arrives in hell, and what he discovers is this sprawling suburb of houses. Think like Los Angeles, like endless suburbs of houses, except they're all empty. And so he asked someone, what's the deal with all this? And it's explained to him that when somebody arrives in hell, they move into one of the houses, and all the new people move into a subdivision. But then pretty quickly, you know, a man has a quarrel with his neighbor, a woman has a quarrel with another woman in her neighborhood, and so, because there's so many houses, they just move into another neighborhood. But then they still have some interaction, and so they have another conflict, and so then they move farther and farther away, and this just keeps on going on. And so then the man asks, well, what about those people who've been here for thousands and thousands of years? And here's the response. They've been moving on and on, getting further apart. They're so far off by now, astronomical distances. There's a bit of a hill near where I live, and a man has a telescope. You can see the lights of the inhabited houses where those old ones live. Millions of miles away, millions of miles from us and from one another. So, being really honest, how many of your relationships have been ruined by pride? The pride of self-centeredness, the pride that refuses to say, I was wrong. The pride that refuses to be the first one to apologize. The pride that always blame shifts to someone else. No nudging your spouse right now, okay? How much has pride ruined your family relationships? I know it's Christmas and we love Christmas. We get together with our extended families and things like that. But how many of you going to your extended family outings over the next few days, there's a bit of a tension going on there because there is past problems which were rooted in somebody's pride. Somebody did something, refused to apologize, and so you're still kind of reaping the effects of it. Pride is what ruins our relationships. So what we need, what I need, is humility. We need to grow in this grace of humility. And this morning, what we're going to see is that the message of Christmas has the power to bring transformation at the very core of who you are as a person. It gets right down to the bottom of who you are, deals with the motivational structure of your heart, and changes you and renews you and brings healing into your relationship. So I'm praying, and you can pray along with me, that this morning God would meet with us in a powerful way, that we would experience the great humility of Christmas and be changed by it, and then it would change our relationships. So here's how I want to develop that. Let's talk about three things. First, let's talk about the virtue of humility. Let me define what it is and what it is not. I think we have a mistaken understanding many times of what humility is. Then the second place, I want to talk about the revolution of humility. And like I've been doing throughout this series, I want us to do a bit of a deep dive into the ancient mindset. And I want to show you that if you value humility today as a virtue, it's because a revolution took place in history of which you are the heir of it. A great revolution took place. Humility has not always been a great virtue in the world, and it's not in every part of the world today. And I'll show you it has everything to do with Christmas. And then finally, we'll talk about the cultivation of humility. How do you cultivate this in your life? First then, let's talk about the virtue of humility. The virtue of humility. Philippians 2, just reading it, it's very clear. There's nothing secretive about this. It's all about humility. It comes up over and over again. And Paul, what he does in this text is he helps us to understand what humility is, and then on the flip side, what it is not. He makes it very clear to us in his descriptions in verses 3 and 4. Look at 3 and 4 with me. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. So we can see here what humility is and what it's not. First of all, humility is not humiliation. Though it comes from the same word, it sounds the same. It comes from the same word meaning low, as in low to the ground. But there's a huge difference between humility and humiliation. The difference is one of willingness. When we humble ourselves, we do so willingly, whereas we unwillingly are humiliated. We all know this, right? I mean, maybe I'm sure you've experienced a little humiliation in your life. Maybe somebody has publicly said something around a group of people. Maybe they betrayed a secret. Maybe they said something about you. And so they humiliated you. That was something that happened unwillingly to you. You would not have wanted it to happen, and your face turns red as your temperature rises, and you feel humiliated. It's an unwilling thing. But humility is something that you do willingly. Humiliation is something that is unwilling. And Paul clearly means humility as in a willing sense. And I see that because Paul says we are to look not only to our own interests, but also to the interests of others. So we are willingly looking to the interests of others. And in verse 3, he says, count others more significant than yourself. So your attitude and the way you think about other people, you're willingly trying to think of others as better than yourself. There's nothing in this passage about being conquered, shamed, being put under someone else's boot, being humiliated. Second clarification. We also see here that humility is not belittling or devaluing oneself or one's abilities. I think a lot of people mistake this. I see this a lot actually in churches, a lot amongst Christians. You know, someone has done something kind and somebody else is complimenting them and thanking them. Oh, no, I didn't do anything. There's nothing great about what I've done here. And I know the motivation for it, but really that's self-depreciation, isn't it? Now, it's not that we want to take credit for things and look great. That's, I think, oftentimes the motivation. But listen, self-depreciation is not the same thing as humility. If God's given you gifts and you're using those gifts out of great joy and someone says, hey, thank you for doing that, the correct response is thank you and praise God that he would allow me to serve others. Not to say, oh, no, I didn't do anything actually. No, you did. You see, self-depreciation is actually false humility because it's still totally focused on self and how do I look to others and how do I come across to others? But humility is not like that at all. Again, let's listen to C.S. Lewis. He's so helpful in this. He says, humility does not mean thinking less of yourself. It means thinking of yourself less. You catch that? So Paul, he's saying, it's not thinking, oh, I'm so terrible, I'm not great. That's not humility. It means you don't really think about yourself at all. That's what humility is. And Paul takes this a whole level further. It's not just that we're not really thinking so much about ourselves. It's that we're focusing on other people. Humility has an outward stance to it. It's looking to the interests of others. So one more time with Lewis, he goes on and says this. Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of person who is always telling you that, of course, he is a nobody. Probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap. I love the English there. He seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. So, let me give you a working definition of humility that emphasizes this outward action side to humility. It's from a man named John Dixon. Humility is the noble choice to forego your status, deploy your resources, or use your influence for the good of others before yourself. So I think that what's not great about that definition, it doesn't begin with that kind of attitude, mentality of humility. I think it's underlying it. An attitude that has an accurate view of self before God and before others, and then chooses to take all of my status and my power and use it on behalf of others. Now, I don't think I've really said anything controversial at this point, have I? In our culture today, humility is something that is quite highly prized. And I don't just mean in Christian circles or religious circles. I mean just right across culture. So I'll give you a couple of kind of secular books that really prize this. There's a very famous business leadership writer named John Collins. He's written a lot of books, and one of the most famous books that he's written is called Good to Great. And what he does in this book is he has researched with his team how good companies like Gillette have made it from being just good companies to being great companies. And so he gives his answers for how companies do this. And one of his primary answers, of his five answers, is what he calls level five leadership. Great companies have level five leadership. And he defines level five leadership as a person who is a CEO probably, who has steely determination and an attitude of humility. So right there, in a secular business leadership book, humility is held up as one of the greatest ways. If you want to be great in business, this is what you need. Or one of the most famous kind of self-help books in our culture, Stephen Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Getting a little old now, but still a very famous book. In that book, Stephen Covey says, humility is the mother of all virtues. So kind of like I was saying before, foundation. He's saying the mother of all virtues. So in our culture, we prize humility. We think it is a very good thing. And we love stories about this too. These are our greatest stories, aren't they? Maybe one of the great stories that we enjoy is the story Les Misérables, where Jean Valjean, after he gets out of jail and he establishes himself and he becomes quite wealthy and powerful, then he almost gives all of that up. He sacrifices almost everything, including his own life, in order to raise Fantine's daughter and to see her do well in the world. He uses all his resources and sacrifices himself for the good of another. We love those kind of stories. We love that kind of humility. So nothing controversial here. But what I want to show you is there is a reason why that's not controversial to you. What I want to show you is that 2,000 years ago, a revolution took place in culture that completely transformed the way that we think about issues like pride and humility, honor and shame. And if you prize humility today, it's because you are one of the children of this revolution and you buy into its ideals wholeheartedly. What is the revolution? Well, in the second place, let's talk about the revolution of humility. I read an interesting book by the man I just quoted, Dr. John Dixon. Listen to who he is. He is the senior research fellow of the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University in Australia. So all these guys in this department, you think ancient historians, so they're doing lots of research and things like that. As they did their research, they came onto something. They began to have a question. They noticed in the literature as they studied Greek history, Roman history, and then subsequently, kind of Christian history and things like that, they noticed that something took place in the history of the world. A revolution took place, and it happened right around the first century. This revolution had to do with how people and culture thought of things like pride, humility, honor, and shame. So Dixon and his team point out that the Greeks and the Romans did not value humility like we do today. They were a culture that focused on honor. They valued honor. All of your life revolved around gaining honor for yourself and for your family and for your nation. It was about honor. So if you're a father, your greatest concern was for your son. And your greatest concern for your son is not that he would live a happy life. That's often what we think today. It's not that he would even make a lot of money or even that he'd live a morally upstanding life. That was not your number one concern as a father. Your number one concern is that your son would grow up to bring honor to himself and to your entire family. That is what drove absolutely everything. You can see this, for instance, in the famous story of Achilles, that great warrior. In the modern version of this, there's a movie called Troy, and Achilles, there's a great speech in there where Achilles doesn't want to go and fight in the battle against Troy. This is the Trojan horse story, right? And so his mother comes and speaks with him, and she wants to convince him to go into this battle. Listen to what she says, because this captures what we're trying to get at. She says, "If you stay in Larissa, you will find peace. You will find a wonderful woman, and you will have sons and daughters who have children, and they will all love you and remember your name. But when your children are dead, and their children after them, your name will be forgotten. But if you go to Troy, glory will be yours. They will write stories about your victories in thousands of years, and the world will remember your name." Now, you can tell that you are a child of the revolution that took place in history by how you respond to that quote. So think about this. Do we send our sons and often our daughters as well into war so that they can gain glory for themselves and never be forgotten? Do we ever seek to motivate? Some of you are in the military here. We have lots of people in the military. Did you go into the military so that your name would be upheld throughout history and glory would be yours? Is that why you went into the military? Maybe you just did it for a paycheck. I don't know. But look at the stories. Look at World War II is probably our greatest example. Why did we send our sons and many of our daughters off to war? Did we send them so they would gain glory? Was that our motivation? No. We sent them because we thought it was the right thing to do. In our culture, we say it's the right thing to do because if you have power and someone else is facing injustice, we think you need to use that power, even at cost to your very own life, in order to meet that injustice, to bring freedom where there is slavery, and use your life and deploy all your resources, even if it means your own life. That's how you know you're a child of this revolution, if you think like that. And I think we all think like that here in the Western world. But that's not how the ancient world thought. And you can hear it in that quote of Achilles. In the ancient world, things were very different. Humility was not considered a great virtue. Let me give you another example. In the 6th century BC, there was a book written by the Greeks, and it outlined 147 maxims, or just sayings, on how to live an ethical life. So this is the condense it all. Here's what it means to live an ethical life. It included things like help your friends, return a favor, despise no one, don't mock the dead, and respect your elders. Of the 147, humility does not even appear on the list. So we just said John Collins, Stephen Covey, secular leadership books, and of course Christianity would say, if you're going to make a list of what it means to live ethically, what it means to have a good ethical life, we're going to put humility either at the top or at least maybe the top five or something like that. It's going to be right up there. It doesn't even appear on their list. The reason for this is because they viewed humility to be the same as humiliation. So the only way that you would humble yourself is perhaps before the gods. And you humbled yourself willingly before the gods because the gods could kill you. That's why you did that. So it's not really willing. It is, but it isn't, if you know what I mean. But what you did not do in the ancient world is show humility to someone who is your equal And especially you did not show it to someone who is less than you in the system of life, the class system of life. And in this context, people thought nothing of praising themselves or having others praise them. Because if you'd earned it, you deserve the honor. And so we see this all throughout ancient history. You remember, for instance, in Luke chapter 2, at Jesus' birth, we read about Jesus being born during the reign of, who is it? Well, I'm thinking a little higher level. He's the local guy. Caesar Augustus, right? Here's a little tips on Caesar Augustus. At the end of his life, he wrote a 2,500-word list of all of his achievements. He had it inscribed in bronze and put over top of his grave. Copies were also sent all around the empire. And nobody cringed at the kind of blatant self-congratulation of this list. He describes his 35 accomplishments. Let me give you a couple. Number 10, my name was inserted in the hymn of the Salii by a decree of the Senate. I don't know why that's great, but it was great for him. Number 15, to each member of the Roman plebs, I paid my father's will under my father's will, 2 months' wages. So he paid a whole bunch of people 2 months' wages. Number 25, I made the sea peaceful and freed it of pirates. Number 34, he describes how after he passed his power off to the Senate, he says, after this time, I excelled all in influence. Now you might think, well, this guy's the emperor. That's what emperors do. They boast about themselves. But the average person did this as well. Remember, just as a man, you wanted to gain honor for yourself through your son. And it was all about this honor. Another example would be Josephus. You know, he's a Jewish historian. He wrote an autobiography. So he wrote a biography about his own life. Here's how he begins. While still a mere boy, about 14 years old, I won universal applause for my love of literature, insomuch that the chief priests and the leading men of the city used to constantly come to me for precise information on some particular in our ordinances. I mean, can you imagine somebody starting an autobiography nowadays with, here's why I'm great and you should read my book? I can think of a few famous people that actually do begin like that, but we'll leave them out of the way. For them, though, this was perfectly normal. If you'd earned it, you deserved the honor. But we, in our culture, we cringe at this kind of boasting. And so what Dixon and his team argue is that a revolution took place in history and that this revolution changed the whole way that we view issues like pride and humility, honor and shame. This is a secular university, by the way, and the secular university traces this, historically speaking, to the birth and the life and the death of Jesus Christ. This is the revolution. The revolution happened around one man and what one man did. So what is this message of Christmas that created this historical revolution in our attitudes about pride and humility, honor and shame? There's probably no better passage we can go to than Philippians chapter 2. As we've seen, Paul is in verses 3 and 4 calling us to forego our status, to use our power and our influence in the interests of others, especially those who are lesser, even with those who are equals. And then what Paul does is he gives us the ultimate example of humility. Walk through this passage with me, and let's just pray that God would freshly show us how glorious this act of humility was. Verse 5, have this mind, Paul writes, among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. Okay, we're supposed to have this mind, this attitude that Jesus had. What was this mindset? What was this attitude of humility that Jesus had? Look at verses 6 and 7. Who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Now, what a shock this verse was to the ancient world. What a shock it should be to you and I today. But oftentimes we've heard this story so many times, and if you've been in church for most of your life, you've heard many sermons on this passage, and maybe even right now you're checking out, you're saying like, I haven't heard this passage so many times. Let's try to recapture some of the freshness of this, some of the shock value that we should feel as we read this. So first of all, if you want to feel the shock of it, recognize who Jesus is. Look at verse 6. Jesus, who though he was in the form of God. So Christianity begins with this belief that Jesus is not just a holy man. He's not just a prophet. That Jesus is none other than God himself. He is in very nature God. He is the one who created the heavens and the one who created the earth. The one to whom all praise and honor is due. So if anyone deserves honor and worship and praise, if anyone's earned it, it's Jesus. But once you've grasped who he is, then grasp what he did. To our shock, verse 6 says, he willingly gave up all of that honor and made himself low. All that honor that was due to him, he gave it up. Notice he says, he did not account equality with God a thing to be grasped. That is, he didn't cling on, grab on to all that honor that was rightfully his. He didn't grasp it and hold tightly to it. But rather, he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Now, just be clear. It's not that he ceased to be God when he became a man. No, God became a man. He gave up his rights as God. That is, he gave up all the privileges that were properly due to him when he became a man. He voluntarily, this is humility, he voluntarily lowered himself. What we see in this text is a high, low, high movement. This is what we see. High. Jesus was high. God, creator of all things. He begins to lower himself. And what we see here is a ladder of lowering. It's a ladder where he takes a step down. He takes a step down. He takes a step down. So right now what I'm seeking to show you is he voluntarily lowered himself by becoming a man. Not just a man, another rung down, a servant man. Now you think that if Jesus, you know, God's going to become a man, okay, that's interesting he would do that. That is lowering himself a lot. Why would you want to do that? But okay, if you're going to do that, if he's going to become a man, then surely he will enter into this world with great ceremony, with great honors given to him. So he'll send a billion angels ahead of him to clear the way. Billions of angels singing in choirs and great trumpet blasts. And then Jesus himself, he'll enter this world with a great blast. Maybe he'll just split the sky open, tear it apart, and come walking through and be like, I am here. Maybe he'll send an archangel ahead of him saying, behold, everyone, your maker, your creator, the one who has given you life and breath and everything else. Bow before your maker. And if we had any sense at all, we would fall on our faces before him and say, oh, it's the one who's made us. He's here. Let's all give him the worship that is due to him. And with great pomp and ceremony, he would set up a great throne in a great palace upon the earth. And he would reign there as the one to whom all honor and worship is due. But that's not how he came. The King of all kings, the creator of all, humbled himself and put on human flesh and came as a vulnerable little baby on a quiet night, unknown to the vast majority of the world. It says he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant. He came as a servant? Wait a minute. God? A servant? A servant God? Who's ever heard of such a thing? Gods don't give up their positions of honor in order to become a man, and even worse, to take another level down, to become a servant? What kind of God is this that he would do such a thing and give up his honor? Why would he do that? But the ladder has not gone down far enough yet. He lowered himself another step. Look at verse 8. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Now, the problem why you don't see that one is because we've sanitized the cross. So God becomes a man. That's a step down. Not just a man, becomes a servant to all men. And then we read that he doesn't just become a servant, but this God-man, this servant God, now has become obedient to death. Wait, the God-man is going to die? But notice that little phrase, again, this is where we can't really grasp this because we've heard it so many times. It doesn't just say death. He didn't die of old age. That still would be something. No, it says even death on a cross. The reason why we are not shocked by this is because we've largely sanitized the cross. The cross, even look at our cross up on the side here. It's all polished up. It's sanded perfectly. It's not a rough beam that you would get splinters on. I don't say it's wrong that we do this. You have a cross, many of you around your neck, it's got gold on it. Maybe it's even got some diamonds on it. But listen, do you realize what we're doing when we put a cross on the wall? Do you realize what the cross is? It is one, perhaps the greatest instrument of torture ever devised by human beings. To get a modern equivalent, which doesn't actually even fully capture, but is as close as I can get, the modern equivalent would be for us to take that cross down and to put an electric chair up on the wall and to hang it there. It'd be like you putting a necklace and hanging a little electric chair around it. Why would you hold a greatest instrument of torture around your neck? Why would you turn an electric chair into jewelry? And yet that's what we've done. I'm not saying it's wrong, but I'm just saying let's capture what it is that we're talking about here. Let's get what's really happening, that the God-man would lower himself not just to death, but to death on a cross. But let's go further. It's not just that it's an instrument of torture. The cross was also devised by the Romans to be the greatest instrument of humiliation. Not just pain, humiliation. Read the story of Jesus' arrest and all the trial and then his crucifixion. Read it all through the lens of shame and humiliation, and you'll just see it's coming out everywhere. Kings wore purple robes. Purple's the symbol of royalty. The guards dressed Jesus in a mock purple robe, knelt before him, and made fun of him as if he were some sort of king. Kings wear crowns upon their heads. They took some thorns, wrapped them into the shape of a crown, and then they pressed them into his skull. In the ancient world and in many parts of the world today, a man's beard is his glory. Isaiah chapter 50 says, they tore out his beard. A profound act of disrespect in an ancient culture. The cross is not just designed to torture, it's designed to shame. And this entire thing was done publicly. This is why the electric chair doesn't really work. It would be like an electric chair in the middle of a town square because it was designed to be public. There was no suffering and dignified privacy. You were exposed for everyone to see, for everyone to make fun of you, for everyone to mock. And so they spit upon him publicly. They made fun of him publicly. And we know from history that when the Romans crucified people, they almost always did it in another way that we try to sanitize, but which is not super historically accurate. We show Jesus with a nicely placed loincloth. Crucifixion victims were almost always crucified naked. You were exposed. We don't know if Jesus was or if he was not. The text doesn't say if he was naked. But considering the historical evidence, we strongly think that he was. You see how we can't sanitize that. The humiliation of it all, the shame of it all, that he, Jesus, is being mocked like this. Oh, he was despised and rejected. A man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces and don't even want to look at, he was despised and we esteemed him not. There's an interesting little piece of archaeological evidence that shows the shame of the cross, the shame of what was going on. We'll show it on the screen. It's a crude piece of graffiti. It dates back to just a few decades after the time of Christ. And what you see is a boy standing beside a cross with his arm raised up in worship. And on the cross is supposed to be Jesus, but you notice Jesus has the head of a jackass. And the caption in Greek, it's in Greek, but what it reads is, Alexemenos worships his God. So apparently there was a young boy, or maybe a teenage boy, and he worshiped Jesus as his God, and his friends are mocking him and humiliating him because they think that the God he worships is a jackass of a criminal. That's the shame that was associated with the cross. So here's the million-dollar question. Why? Why would God walk down the ladder of shame like this? Every step, taking away the honor that is due to him, and even further down, not just losing the honor, but taking on mockery, taking on humiliation. Why would God do this? Well, the answer to that question is verses 3 and 4. He did nothing out of selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility, Jesus counted others more significant than himself. He not only looked to his own interests, he looked to the interests of others, meaning he did all of this for you and for me. He went to the cross. He was born and then went to the cross so that you and I might be rescued, for we could not save ourselves. We were lost in our sins. We were under condemnation, but God, in this tremendous act of humility and love, lowered himself, walked down the ladder of shame in order that he might bring us back up the ladder into glory. That is why he did it. There's a story about a missionary who was serving in a very hot and dry part of Africa. And in this place, there was a well, but it's not like wells like you and I think of, where you put the bucket way down and then you bring out a big thing of water. It was such a dry place that they had to sink deep shafts down into the ground. And there was no water at the bottom, but what would happen is the water would condense on the walls of the well. And so what you needed to do is people would go in every day and they would scrape the water off of the wall so that it would drain down to the bottom of the well where there was no water, eventually making a little puddle. Then you would take rags, scoop up the water, and you would squeeze it into a bucket so that people could have some water to drink. One day, a man was going down to do this job, and he fell. And he fell all the way down the well, and he broke his legs so that he was lying on the bottom of the well. Everyone looked in. They heard his cries for help, but nobody would go down to help him. He was a big man. And everyone knew if you tried to go down to help him, you would try to carry him up, and you too would fall down. So you would probably die in trying to save him. So no one did anything until the chief came out. And in that tribe, as so often in these tribal structures, the chief was the strongest and largest man in the entire tribe. And he stood looking down the well, and he stood there for a few moments, and then he took off his tribal robes and he laid them aside. He took off his headdress, which was his version of a crown, and he laid it aside. And then the chief of the tribe climbed down into the well. The chief got dirty. The chief risked his life, went to the bottom, and pulled that man out and rescued him. Friends, this is the story of Christianity. This is the story of Christmas. That God, in a great act of humility, took off his crown and laid it to the side, took off his royal robes, laid them to the side, left all the glory of heaven that was his, came down into this dark well of this world where we as a human race were lying broken on the bottom of the well, unable to rescue ourselves. And Jesus didn't just risk his life to rescue us. He gave up his life to rescue us. So Jesus traded worship for mockery. He traded adoration for someone's spit coming down his face. Jesus traded the crown of glory for thorns twisted and pressed into his skull. He traded power for weakness. He traded his mighty omnipotent strength for being punched in the face. He, the healer of all, allowed himself to be scourged 39 times with the cat of nine tails. And the message of Christmas is, he did this for you and for me. He did this to rescue us. He went down the ladder of shame And for this, the verses go on to say, because he did this, therefore, verse 9, God exalted him to the highest place. God says, if you will do this, my son, I will give you the highest place. I will give you the name above all names. I will give you all the worship and honor that is due to you. For you were at the high place. You went to the low place. And so I will bring you up to the high place. And so, friends, this is the message of humility. The message of humility is simply that we need to humble ourselves like our Savior. The way to greatness is to become low. The way to glory is to humble yourself. The way to be pleasing to God is to give your life on behalf of others. So Dixon and his team, as they studied all of this, that was their conclusion. That historically speaking, no spiritual sense at all from their perspective, a revolution took place, and that revolution in history had everything to do with this man, Jesus, who scorned the shame of the cross, and because of this was exalted to glory. So Dixon and his team concluded this way. Honor has been redefined, greatness recast. If the greatest man who has ever known chose to forego his status for the good of others, greatness must consist in humble service. The shameful place is now the place of honor. The low point is the high point. And that's what we see in this passage today. This high, low, high movement that Jesus walked, and then what he calls his followers to walk as well. That's the revolution. Now let's just spend 3 or 4 more minutes and get this really practical. Let's talk about the cultivation of humility. How do you cultivate this in your life? I think we all need to hear this. I don't know about you. Our own hearts are just so self-centered. This is where all our problems come in. This is why we have so many problems with other people, why we have relational breakdown, is our own pride. We need a humble heart. So how do we get that? How do we cultivate that? 2 things from this text. First, cultivate humility by just filling your heart with the message of Christmas. This is the way you do it. You cultivate it by filling your heart with the message of Christmas. Isn't that what Paul is calling us to do? Verses 3 and 4 is the command, be humble, act humbly. But how do you do it? How do you stop being so self-obsessed? Well, Paul goes on, and he shows you how to do it. You develop the mindset, the attitude of Jesus. Because you see, notice what Paul doesn't do. And this is what I don't want to do as the preacher. Don't want to just get up and say, you need to be humble, now act like it. Get to it, people. Here's where you're bad at it, and this is how you need to be better at it. Come on, let's do this. It's because that can't get to the deep motivational structures of your heart. That kind of command of me hammering you or Paul hammering you, it's not going to change your hearts. And right at the root of all this is not just actions. At the root of it is a motivational structure that's wrong. It's a motivational structure that is inward bent. We are the bent ones. We are bent in on ourselves. So how then do we get bent and straightened so we're going more outward? How do we do that? Not by getting hammered, but by having our hearts melted. If you want to bend a metal rod, you can hammer it all you want. It might bend a little bit, but you might break it if you keep hammering it. If you want to bend metal, you heat it up, you melt it, and when you do that, it'll retain its shape. And what Paul is seeking to do with us in verses 5 to 11 is to melt our hearts, to just melt our hearts with, this is what God has done for me. He who is high walk the ladder of shame to become low so that I might be able to be taken up into glory. And when you see God himself doing this, you're brought up into the story of the world, the story of history, the story of the universe. You see the supreme being doing this. What it does is it melts your heart. So that's the first way. You got to change the motivational structure of your heart. How do you do that? By just living daily in the good news of the gospel. That's why you need to read the Word, be in the Word all the time. It's why you need to be in church on Sunday, not because there's a rule, but because when we're here, we sing the gospel, we preach the gospel, we celebrate in the baptism and the Lord's Supper, and so we're renewed constantly. We need to constantly be putting ourselves back in the story of this good news and having our hearts melted again and again and again, for we are the bent ones and we need to be straightened. Second, cultivate humility by serving others. This is so obvious in the text, isn't it? That's the whole point of it. Humility is not just an attitude. It's an attitude that shows itself in action. Jesus didn't just have a good attitude of humility. His attitude showed itself in action. So here's my challenge for you at the end of this message. What is one specific way that you can use your power and influence in service to others this week? Let's get really practical. Just one way, you can think of maybe millions if you want, but let's get one tangible way that you can use your power and service for the good of others. I mean, think about this. This will bring renewal to your marriage if it's broken. If you think, okay, what could I do for my spouse that they know I wouldn't really want to do, but they would like me to do, and I do it? What is that thing? What could you do for that, your spouse? This could bring renewal to your marriage if you start having that kind of attitude. How could I serve my spouse? What an attitude shift. What a transformation if you are bent on serving your spouse and looking out for what their interests are. This would bring complete renewal in your workplace. What would happen in your office and all the dynamics and things that go on there, all the drama that happens? What would happen if you were saying, how could I serve those who are not just my superiors, those who are my equals who compete with me, and those who are beneath me who want my job? What if I serve them? How could you serve them? This will transform your extended family. So it's Christmas time. There's a whole lot of conflict about to come some of our way as we go to our extended family gatherings. I know because, we come back from Christmas, and lots of times people are like, oh, it was good, but oh, man, I was glad it was only 24 hours. But what would change is if you walked in with your extended family this Christmas and your whole attitude was, how can I serve people here? How can I make this a great time for other people? Rather than being bent in on yourself and your own needs. It would renew your extended family. It will transform and renew our church. What if this next year, rather than guarding our own time and our finances or things like that, we said, I'm going to pour myself out. I want to see a strong church for the sake of the glory of God in this city, and I'm going to work and labor to that end. Oh, it would change everything. And it will transform the world, bring renewal to the world. What can you do to serve the poor, the hurting, the handicapped, the elderly, the unborn, the orphan, or the single parent? There's opportunities everywhere around us. What is one specific way that you can use your power and influence in the service of others? And I would be remiss if I didn't end this way. Perhaps there are some of you here this morning who you're just looking into Christianity. This is new to you. You're not a Christian. You've heard all kinds of things about how terrible Christianity is, and all kinds of stories on, the God of the Bible is horrible, and he does all these horrible things. Listen to the God of the Bible. Here you have what the God of the universe is really like. Is this not an admirable picture? Is this not the kind of God you want to worship? A God who would humble himself like that for you when you didn't deserve it? He would do that? Oh, that's a glorious God. Perhaps today you say, yeah, I want to worship that God. Bow your knee before him and just say, Jesus, you're the God I want to worship. I want to turn my life over to you. I want you to forgive me and to rescue me. Come and save me because he is so worthy of worship. Who has ever heard of a God like this? Who would descend the ladder of shame in order that you might be brought to glory.